Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
The International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea is now in session. L'audience du Tribunal International du Droit de la Mer est ouverte.
21 women and men cloaked in black judicial robes settle into their seats inside a hearing room. Chances are you've never heard of this special tribunal, and this audio is from its own website. It's in Hamburg, Germany. More often than not, the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea handles disputes between maritime nations about fisheries, borders, or ships that may be where they're not supposed to be. At this hearing, though, the subject is climate change. And the stakes for one of the lawyers, a recent graduate named Naima Temaile Fifita, couldn't be higher. She represents her own island nation, Tuvalu.
Mr. President, distinguished members of this tribunal, it is a great privilege and honor to appear before you as counsel as an indigenous Tuvaluan, as a youth, and as a mother to a daughter of the Pacific who opened her eyes to this world just 1 year ago. As I address this distinguished tribunal at this historic proceeding, my fears are for the kind of world she will inherit when the land of her ancestors is taken by the rising sea.
Naima is wearing a headband and a necklace styled from cowrie seashells. Along with eight other small island states, Tuvalu is asking the tribunal to issue an opinion on what the world's larger nations, those most responsible for emissions, global warming, and sea rise, are obligated to do to protect the sea and countries like hers.
In some Pacific cultures, the word for placenta, island, and soil are the same. Fenua. All of these terms represent home and connection. The island and the islander are one and the same. The relationship between the two is a deeply spiritual and reciprocal bond reliant on the other's existence. A bond that shapes every aspect of a Pacific person's individual and collective identity.
Naima made those submissions last fall, and it's not the first time island nations have made pleas for help. But turning to international tribunals is something new, and that's why we're looking into the case today. I'm Laura Lynch, and you're listening to What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions. The judges will release their precedent-setting statement on climate change and the world's oceans on May the 21st. The lead lawyer for Tuvalu and other small island states is Payam Akhavan. He's the human rights chair at Massey College in Toronto. Hello.
Hello.
You recently visited one of these small nations, Tuvalu. I'm wondering what you thought of what you saw there.
Well, Tuvalu is one of the smallest nations on Earth, but the main island, Funafuti, which is about 2 hours flight away from Fiji in the South Pacific, is about 2.5 square kilometers. The runway, which only accommodates small aircraft, is about 1.5 kilometers, and it basically covers the entire length of the island. And upon arriving, you begin to see just how vulnerable this nation is to rising sea levels. Tuvalu has about 11,000 indigenous inhabitants, and the island is so small that the runway at the airport, in fact, is also a playground for children. And whenever the aircraft lands, it's someone's job to chase the children as well as the dogs and cats off the runway so the aircraft can land. And when you travel in the island, and by travel, I really mean it takes about 15 minutes by motorbike to go from one end of the island to the other, you begin to see just how vulnerable this nation is to rising sea levels, and how the small islands such as Tuvalu, that these islands are the canary in the coal mine of climate catastrophe. So Tuvalu is about 1.5 meters above sea level on average. And at just a temperature rise of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures, which in effect is the target of the 2015 Paris Agreement that was concluded to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions, even at 1.5 degrees, a significant part of the island will be submerged. At 2 degrees Celsius, the island would probably become uninhabitable unless hundreds of millions of dollars were invested in adaptation to raise the island, in effect, through land reclamation projects. So the people of Tuvalu are contending with the possibility that in the foreseeable future, their nation will simply disappear under the Pacific Ocean.
And so I'm wondering, the people that you met there, what are they saying to you about that?
Well, on the one hand, as I explained, the Tuvaluans are indigenous peoples, and that really profoundly shapes both their view of humankind's place in the universe, the reverence with which we should look at nature, which includes being guardians of the environment, custodians of the natural world, and they have a very profound tie to their ancestral territories. So for them, it's especially tragic to think that they may have to basically leave the island, that the entire population may have to leave and go to either Fiji or Australia or some other country. And of course, the world can look the other way and say, who cares about 10,000 people in the South Pacific? But what is happening to them is going to happen to the rest of the world. So this is a global phenomenon. And what the small island states are going through is really a warning for all of us about what is ahead if we don't take the question of climate change seriously and radically and immediately reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
You may have already answered my next question, but I'll ask you, why did you want to be involved in this case?
In a former life, I was a UN prosecutor dealing with crimes against humanity and genocide. And of course, both as an international lawyer, but also as a concerned global citizen, you begin to see that while we are so concerned about mass atrocities, the injustice of it, the human suffering, which moves us deeply, that climate change, in fact, is a catastrophe unfolding in slow motion, and it's going to affect all of us. We may be indifferent towards a war or atrocity in some distant country that we read about in the news. We cannot be indifferent about climate change because it's going to affect each and every one of us sooner or later. So in my view, if international law has nothing to say about a phenomena which is going to affect the very survival of humankind, then what good is it? And when we see the flooding in Dubai, the unbearable heat in cities in India, the catastrophic forest fires in Canada, when we see the air in New York being described as apocalyptic because people cannot breathe it because of the smoke coming from the forest fires, and we realize that this is just the beginning, we have to ask ourselves, why are world leaders asleep at the switch?
I just want to move on to the case itself without getting too technical. You were before 21 judges last fall at the tribunal, and that opinion, as I said, is due soon from the courts. What is it that your clients want those judges to do?
The Paris Agreement has failed to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions because states operating in a voluntary scheme have not taken seriously what is scientifically required to protect us from catastrophic harm. So the small island states concluded in the year 2021 at the 26th UN Conference on Climate Change, so-called COP26 in Glasgow in Scotland, that they're going to turn towards international law, because while the major polluters are avoiding doing what is necessary, international law already obligate states to prevent harm to other states. It's called the principle of transboundary harm. It's very well established. So if you have a factory chimney which is spewing toxic fumes which are carried by the wind into a neighboring state and creating harm, well, you're under obligation to cease that conduct and to provide compensation for the injury that is caused. So why would we treat greenhouse gas emissions any different from any other form of pollution? And the principle is called the polluter pays. So the small island states brought this case before the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, which is based in Hamburg, and that is the guardian of the 1982 UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which is the Constitution of the Oceans. And part of that involves exacting obligations for states to protect and preserve the marine environment. So the small island states brought this case, bearing in mind that the ocean is by far the biggest heat sink in the world. 93% of excess heat is absorbed by the oceans. So it's not just the problem of rising sea levels, it's the problem of acidification of water, the bleaching of coral reefs. At just 1.5 degrees, 70 to 90% of coral reefs in the world will be bleached. It will destroy biodiversity, it will destroy fisheries. And the case really was the first step in really speaking truth to power, basically telling the major polluters, never mind the negotiations, which have failed to bring us anywhere near where we should be. You are already under an obligation under international law to prevent significant harm. And in effect, very often it's the major polluters who are lecturing others on the rule-oriented international order. And now it's the smallest of nations on Earth, Tuvalu population 11,000, together with other countries in the Caribbean and the Pacific, that remarkably are engaged in this David and Goliath contest, telling the major polluters, you must stop what you're doing because you're not only causing this horrible damage to us, but you will ultimately regret it because of the damage will be inflicted on your own people as well.
Those major polluters were involved as well. They had their say in it. I should note, though, that the United States was not involved because they are not a signatory to the convention and the tribunal that is established by it. Canada is a party to it and filed its own submission to the tribunal. What do you think of Canada's submission and what it said?
You're correct. The United States is not a party to this treaty. Canada's position is reflecting the position of most of the other Western countries. On the one hand, Canada recognizes in its written statement that climate change must be taken seriously. It refers in particular to the Arctic, which is heating at four times the global average. It refers to the indigenous peoples as custodians of the environment and all of that. But when it comes to the actual legal issues, Canada's position, similar to that of the United Kingdom, the United States, Australia, a number of others, is that international law, including the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, cannot go beyond what states have agreed to in the Paris Agreement. The problem with that is the Paris Agreement provides very few obligations and, in fact, leaves it for states to decide how quickly or how dramatically they will reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And as I explained, the Paris Agreement has failed to ensure that greenhouse gas emissions are such that we will remain within the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature rise by the year 2100. That's the whole reason why small island states, frustrated with 30 years of futile negotiations in the UN climate change regime, that's why they decided to go before international courts and tribunals. So it will remain to be seen on May 21st what the tribunal will say. I'm fairly confident the tribunal will not say that states can make unilateral commitments that are grossly inadequate and still comply with their obligations under international environmental law. That cannot be the case.
the tribunal is issuing only an opinion, and it's not binding. How can this then advance the cause of small island states?
The opinion is and is not binding in the sense that it's not a judgment in a dispute between two parties, but it is an authoritative statement of the binding law. So at the very least, that authoritative statement of the binding international law will hopefully help shape future negotiations on questions such as mitigation and adaptation, and the question of loss and damages, which has been very controversial. The small island states are saying, if you're not going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, then you must pay compensation for the harm that you are causing us. So I think that it will, over time, change the conversation, the framing of the negotiations. And in addition, we now have a proliferation of legal action against major polluters, be they companies, potentially governments. Just recently, the European Court of Human Rights found in a judgment on behalf of a group of women pensioners against Switzerland that Switzerland, of all countries, does not have sufficiently ambitious targets in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So it's only a matter of time before law, and international law in particular, begins to shape how we address the problem of climate change.
But we know that legal actions can take a very long time, and here you are saying we don't have time.
We have to try whatever options we have available. And once again, I don't think litigation is going to solve the problem. The problem is complex. It requires states to come back to this COP process, the UN annual UN Climate Change Conference. We need Paris Agreement 2.0, which has teeth, which is much more vigorous, much more ambitious, specific obligations geared towards the 1.5 degree temperature target, and means of enforcement. So what we have is a global problem that is threatening our future, our very existence, but we don't have the institutions that allow for effective global governance. So the question is, how much harm do we have to suffer before we wake up and realize that filling our SUV with cheap gas is less important than making sure that future generations have a planet on which they can live?
I just want to end by taking you back to Tuvalu, in your mind anyway. And I'm wondering what message you have for the people of Tuvalu as they wait for to hear what the tribunal has to say.
Well, it's heartbreaking to see these people who have made negligible contributions to the problem, but who suffer its most catastrophic consequences. I leave Tuvalu with this incredible reverence and respect for what their culture has to teach us. But on the other hand, one has to apologize to these people, apologize that we have become so intoxicated by our materialism and our desire to have what we imagine is a certain standard of living, that we are not only destroying their future, but we're destroying also our own future, the future of our children. So the madness has to stop. And it may be written in history that it was the smallest of nations on earth that told us what we need to do.
Paya Makavan, thank you.
Thank you.
And I want to give the last word on this to Naima Tamaile-Fifita. In her closing remarks before the tribunal, she turned to a personal story to underscore that this isn't just another case for her.
I am here before you today, Mr. President, because of an exchange I had with my grandfather at 12 years of age. I had asked him how he felt about the idea that Tuvalu, his homeland, could soon disappear due to sea level rise. After a moment's reflection, he responded, "It will never be gone." Only 5 years later, however, he relayed to me with great sadness that one of the islands in Tuvalu, where he spent many of his childhood years, had completely disappeared under the sea. Climate change is already wreaking havoc on our precious ancestral lands. Mr. President, to ensure that my grandfather's declaration holds true, to ensure that Tuvalu never disappears, I endeavor to do my part. In 10 years from now, I hope to still be able to take my daughter to the island in Tuvalu, after which he named me, Te Maile.
My name is Rudy Kelly, and I am an Aboriginal.
I am Chief.
My dad was a great chief of the Tsimshian Nation, beloved by his people. But at home, with his family, he brought anger and pain. He told me that to succeed, I would have to leave everything behind. Now I'm on a journey to find out who and what my dad really was. The Aboriginal is an all-new CBC podcast. Available now.
So recently on What on Earth, our producer Molly Siegel tackled a question from a curious listener, Marion May. She wanted to know, what is the more climate-friendly choice, washing your dishes by hand, which she loves to do, or using the dishwasher?
I detest the sound of a dishwasher. That's why I really like to hand wash dishes, and I find it very therapeutic. I use the hottest water possible and my lovely pink washing gloves.
All right, Marion, we heard from you, and Molly's in studio now to share some of the feedback we heard from others about this. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Laura. So as you'll probably remember, we discovered that a fully loaded dishwasher is more energy efficient. And I have to admit, I was a bit surprised by the number of emails we got after we aired this story.
Yeah, I think we can safely call it an avalanche of emails.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were dozens of them. And there were a fair number of those that were asking about the scope of the environmental impact in the story that I did tackle. So in her email, Jill Meadowbank on PEI pointed out that, quote, you did not talk about the cost of building / shipping and recycling / scrapping a dishwasher. It is true. I did not. Barry Salaberry shared a similar concern that the full environmental calculation wasn't included. And he wrote, the extraction of minerals and their industrial transformation into the actual appliance is considerable. Missed also, the fossil fuels used to extract via mining equipment, the transportation via fossil fuel vehicles, the fossil fuel extraction, eventual transformation into the plastic components of the appliance, the transportation and storage, and marketing of all appliances is considerable.
Okay, yeah, you've got a point there, Barry, and that's something, a calculation that we could do for everything we use, including dishwashing and dishwashing soap and cutlery, all that kind of stuff. But I don't know if we'd be able to put a number on the CO2 emissions of marketing. But your point is taken, Barry.
Yeah. Christy in Edmonton also wrote to ask about the embedded energy of building, transporting, and disposing of a dishwasher. And she also added, quote, I agree with your caller that the meditative aspect of dishwashing can be quite lovely.
I think that's a personal choice for everyone, quite frankly. I would far rather put them in the dishwasher than wash them by hand. I don't find and meditative. I think of it more like a chore, but I can understand that. The benefits may tip the scale one way or the other, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm with you there. I prefer using a dishwasher for ease, but yeah, like no judgment. Maybe it works for some people, like it does for Marion. Anyways, Will Chandler shared some similar thoughts about the benefits of washing dishes by hand. He writes, the health I gain from standing, using my fingers and hands, arms and body coordination, circulation and warm water on my hands far outweighs the little bit of water. And then he goes on to say, quote, when we don't use it, we lose it. We're required to use our bodies and our minds at menial tasks to stay healthy. And the more I do for myself, the healthier I am at 75.
And I applaud that, Will. Bravo. But I got to say, when I'm loading a dishwasher, I'm using my brain because I'm one of those people who likes to arrange everything just precisely so I can get everything in as much as I can get in. And I agree, you use it or you lose it. Thank you.
Julie Alexander in Muskoka wrote to us to say, quote, "When I wash by hand, I do not fill the sink or a tub with hot water as my mother did a long, long time ago. I'm 85. I let the water run as I wash and rinse, so I'm using a lot more hot water. You did not address the different ways of hand washing. Now I'll try to learn more about my secondhand dishwasher and use it as efficiently as possible." Now, Laura, several people told us that they think they can use less water by washing dishes by hand. And we learned like a lot about the different ways that people do their dishes.
Yeah, a lot. It was astounding.
Yeah. But I also did want to just take a moment to clarify something that I actually think confused a number of people in the story. Our energy efficiency expert, Sarah Riddell, told us that a dishwasher can hold about 8 or more entire meals worth of dishes. And if you did that same number of dishes by hand in the sink, you could use as much as 100 liters of water. So it's not to say that if you and one other person sit down for dinner, you're going to use 100 liters of water to clean those two sets of dishes.
Right.
Just that the equivalent amount could use as much as 100 liters of water. And so even if your dishwasher was not an efficient one, if it is fully loaded, it's still likely to use less hot water for that amount of dishes than doing them by hand.
And we're assuming here that people are using hot water for hygiene, right?
Yeah, that assumption is baked in. To wrap up, though, I do want to share one more little fun thing from Anne-Marie Hunter in Kamloops, who sent us a note of appreciation from Marion May, our listener with the dishwashing question, who said that a dishwasher could change how she cleans up after a dinner party. Anne-Marie says, "I just have to write to tell you that when Marion shared how she was now going to, quote, throw them in the dishwasher, the dishes, not the guests, I laughed out loud. Such a great and funny comment to make."
And I laughed out loud, too. And I think everybody, you laughed. Everybody did.
Delightful.
We love Marion. I really enjoyed hearing from her. Thank you, Molly.
You're welcome, Laura.
Remember, you can listen to all of our episodes on demand at CBC Listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We drop 2 new podcasts every week, and while you're there, leave us a review. That's all for us. The show was put together by Andy Mullins, Danielle Piper, Vivian Luck, Rachel Sanders, Molly Siegel, Matthias Wilson, and Catherine Rolfson. I'm Laura Lynch. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.